We need to get something done by next May, else the residents are going to be hit with a mill and a half of property tax increase.
Fairbanks city leaders approve funds to help residents with contaminated well water. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, September 26th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Senate plan to repeal the Affordable Care Act is dead.
Is the devil in the detail? Yes. And so were we there yet? No.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
A U.S. Senate bill to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act is dead. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell today canceled a planned vote after too many Republicans declared they would not support the Graham Cassidy bill. Senator Lisa Murkowski has been seen as a pivotal vote because she helped block a repeal bill this summer. But as of this evening, she's still not clearly saying how she would have voted on Graham Cassidy.
Everybody wants to know, what would you have done? You know what? The real question is what do we do? What do we do now?
This week was the deadline to pass the health care bill as part of the budget, which would have required just 50 Senate votes. Under Senate rules, the usual threshold is 60. Now that the calendar pressure is off, Murkowski says the Senate should hold bipartisan hearings and construct a health care bill that can be thoroughly studied. She says she likes the central idea of Graham Cassidy, that states would have more flexibility and control over their health care dollars.
Can I get behind an idea like that? Yeah. But is the devil in the detail? Yes. And so were we there yet? No.
She says she wasn't convinced the bill had adequate protection for people with pre-existing conditions or a strong ban on the return of lifetime limits for insurance claims. The bill's sponsors tried to sweeten the bill for Alaska with measure after measure that would have sent money to the state. Murkowski says Senators Lindsey Graham and Bill Cassidy dug into the Alaska particulars and learned how expensive it is to deliver health care in the state. Murkowski says their concerns seemed genuine, beyond just courting her vote.
If you can get people intrigued with your state and then willing to help you, that makes all the difference in the world.
Senator Dan Sullivan didn't declare a position on Graham Cassidy either. He issued a statement saying he was convinced the bill would have brought more funds to Alaska. He called the bill compelling, but said they ran out of time to study the effects. The Fairbanks City Council approved an ordinance on Monday that's intended to help provide drinking water for property owners in an area on the city's south side who've lost the use of their wells due to groundwater contamination. Mayor Jim Matherly says it's only the first step toward addressing the mounting costs of the contamination problem. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The council voted 5-1 to approve an amended ordinance that would provide a $2,500 stipend for 2 years to help pay water bills for property owners along 30th Avenue near the Regional Fire Training Center, who until recently had used their wells for drinking water. Councilwoman Valerie Therrien says she voted no because she didn't believe the ordinance would do enough to compensate those residents fairly for the loss of their drinking water supply.
$2,500 just isn't enough to me.
Therrien proposed paying the water bills for property owners who were most affected by the contamination for 5 years. The other council members rejected that motion over a concern it would cost the city too much, but agreed to her amendment to set the stipend at $2,500, not up to $2,500. Councilman Jerry Cleworth said the city had to draw a line somewhere.
All I can say is it's a compromise. It probably won't make very many people happy.
The ordinance authorizes appropriating $100,000 for the stipends. Councilman David Prues, who co-sponsored the ordinance, says the city in part modeled the stipend after the system North Pole set up earlier this year to help its residents deal with groundwater contamination caused by a chemical substance that leaked from an oil refinery in that city.
Their stipend was $2,000 over a 2-year period. So we took their stipend and increased it.
City engineer Jackson Fox told Pruse that since Fairbanks officials learned about the contamination last year, the city's paid out more than $3 million to survey the problem and clean up around the training facility. That amount also covered the cost of connecting 20 properties with the area water system operated by Golden Heart Utilities and for providing drinking water to those and another 20 properties in the area that have yet to be hooked up.
We could be looking at connecting another 25 or so homes next summer.
Fox told the council that each hookup will cost the city $35,000, and Pruse used that figure to estimate the total amount the city will have to pay in the coming year to mitigate the problem.
So we're looking at basically 65 to 70 more homes, not including a water stipend at $35,000, added on to the $3 million that we've already spent.
Yes.
So we're looking at about $5.5 million.
Cleworth says that equates to about $1.5 million increase in the city's property tax. And he says that's why the council must move quickly to limit payouts and other costs and to recover compensation from the manufacturer of the firefighting foam and other parties.
We need to get something done by next May, else the residents are going to be hit with $1.5 million of property tax increase.
Therrien asked City Attorney Paul Ewers whether he's been notified of any legal claims filed against the city over the contamination issue.
We don't have any lawsuits that were filed. We've had basically claims inquiries and just starting those discussions.
Mayor Jim Matherly told council members the city must talk with officials from other agencies that have used the training center about their possible liability. He says he talked about that with Governor Bill Walker last week while he was in town. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska Native and conservation groups are asking the federal government to investigate the effects that existing or planned mines in British Columbia could have on waters flowing into southeast Alaska. The groups today sent a petition seeking an investigation to U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross. The ultimate goal of their request is to have the issue referred to an international panel, something the groups have long been seeking without success. The groups say the transboundary rivers are important to Alaska communities, providing salmon that Alaska Natives and commercial fishermen rely on. They worry not enough is being done to monitor the development of mines across the border from southeast Alaska in British Columbia. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, remembering Native rights activist Deesa Jacobson.
She was a ball of fire. She never wanted violence against Native women to be ignored.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Yupik and Gwich'in political activist Deesa Jacobson has died. She was 69. Jacobson is remembered for her weeks-long fasts and multiple arrests to call attention to violence against Alaska Native women, Native rights, subsistence, and environmental issues. Today, that work is remembered as family, friends, and supporters gathered in Anchorage for her funeral. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur brings us memories of Deesa.
Deesa Jacobson titled her final political campaign, BOOBS. It's an acronym for Bothered Over Outrageous Budget Shortfalls. She started the campaign in January to protest the Alaska legislature's budget cuts to law enforcement. She didn't want sexual assault victims left vulnerable in a state where many villages already don't have officers. The title, BOOBS, was provocative, unapologetic, and female, just like most of Jacobson's work. But a cancer diagnosis in February cut her campaign short.
There's always a sense of pride in what she stood up for.
Teresa Jacobson grew up attending protest with her mother.
And sometimes it was difficult because not everybody agrees with the way that she went about it or were uncomfortable with what she was bringing up.
Teresa called her mother's parenting non-traditional. More than once, Teresa found out her mother's latest activism the same way everyone else did.
I remember one time I was ironing my clothes and I could hear my mother's voice and I thought, what the heck? And I looked up and I looked at the news and there she was.
Jacobson was protesting the Anchorage Police Department in the early 2000s after it became known that a number of Alaska Native women had been found dead and the crimes remained unsolved. University of Alaska faculty member Diane Benson protested beside her.
She was a ball of fire. She never wanted violence against Native women to be ignored.
Both Jacobson and Benson were survivors of sexual violence and wanted a different future for Native women. In 2002, they ran for governor and lieutenant governor as Green Party candidates. They were the first Native women to run for these seats and won about 3% of votes.
One of my favorite memories is watching her with the press, and she engaged so easily. You know, she would have this glint in her eye and big smile, and then say exactly what she needed to say.
The duo served on panels addressing sexual violence against Native women and worked to disrupt Governor Sean Parnell's Choose Respect rallies. The women said the message oversimplified and diminished the problem while obscuring the core issue, power. Police led Jacobson away in handcuffs at one rally when she attempted to approach Senator Lisa Murkowski speaking at a podium. Her more famous activism involved up to 3 weeks without eating to raise attention for sexual violence. She called them fast, not hunger strikes. A strike can imply violence. Her campaign sought the opposite. Despite the lack of calories and bodily stress, she never stopped working. Lisa Hagblom at Bristol Bay's domestic violence shelter remembers Jacobson flying to Dillingham to help them during a fast.
That's a really hard thing to do, to put yourself underneath that strain to make a point. And she believed in it enough to keep on doing it while she was here.
Jacobson helped the shelter produce multiple videos, like this one from 2005.
If we look into ourselves for a solution, that requires action. And that action is what quells silence and apathy.
Jacobson's daughter, Teresa, says in the days following her mother's death, she's received a cascade of thank yous for her mother's actions and the affirmation that these actions are what allowed so many others to stand. Jacobson was born in Hooper Bay and died in Anchorage on Thursday, September 21st. Reporting in Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Disa Jacobson was buried today at the Anchorage Memorial Park Cemetery. The First Alaskans Institute has announced the keynote speakers for the Elders and Youth Conference just ahead of the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention this October in Anchorage. The elder keynote address will be given by Claire Swan of the Kenaitse Indian Tribe, a longtime advocate for Native fishing rights in Cook Inlet and on the Kenai Peninsula. Swan also served on the board of directors for CIRI, the regional corporation for Cook Inlet. The youth keynote speaker is Chris Apossengok of Gamble on St. Lawrence Island. The 16-year-old gained notoriety earlier this year when he landed a harpoon strike on a whale during a successful subsistence hunt. An online backlash ensued after a radical conservationist criticized the teenager online, sparking national attention. The 34th Elders and Youth Conference begins October 16th. School has been underway in Igiagik for a couple of weeks now. This year, even the youngest set are included. The village has opened a Yupik immersion program for infants to five-year-olds. KDLG's Avery Lill has more.
Four kids toddle around a cozy room. There are all the items you might expect in a pre-kindergarten classroom. Stuffed animals, puzzles, and teachers. The puzzles are the kind with a hole cut out for each piece, and each piece is labeled in Yupik. Annie Wilson is an Igiagig elder, and she speaks her native language fluently. She and 16-month-old Tegan Wassily are playing with a puzzle. Unglu means nest. It's a part of the larger program, Wankuda Gonhayare Nanbach Bahamu Yuchstun, which means we all speak Lake Iliamna Yupik. The village started the program with an $8,500 language preservation and maintenance grant from the U.S. Administration for Native Americans. The grant is in its third and final year. For the past 2 years, language apprentices have learned the language from elders who speak their regional dialect of Yupik fluently. Apprentices have also taught in the village school 30 minutes a day, 4 days a week during the school year. Now they're expanding their efforts. Elders and apprentices are teaching a handful of toddlers 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Alexandra Salmon is the project director. She herself is a language apprentice.
It's far more than language. It's spiritual, mental, physical. It's everything into becoming, you know, what the Yupik really were.
The vision behind UNGLU is for kids to grow up learning to speak Yupik from their earliest days. Loretta Peterson is learning alongside her daughter, Tegan.
It's just better for her to grow up with her original language. I only knew a small handful of words before I started.
And the kids are learning. A lot of them are too young to talk. But when Salmon tells her son to point at different parts of his body, like his knees and his toes, the three-year-old does it without hesitation. In Igyagig, I'm Avery Lill.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
The extraordinary sight of a 30-foot-long dead humpback whale that washed up on a beach area in Anchorage over the weekend has drawn dozens of onlookers to gawk at its carcass. Among them today were veterinarians working with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration who got a much closer look as they began a necropsy in the hopes of figuring out how the young whale died. Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove was there.
It's a short walk from Kincaid Park to the dead whale, which, for now, sits in the Anchorage Coastal Wildlife Refuge. NOAA biologist Barbara Mahoney is happy about the easy access.
It's affordable. You know, there's no helicopters involved. We can have a big crew here. So this is actually a great opportunity, and it's a lovely day.
Mahoney and her crew, including veterinarians from the Alaska Sea Life Center in Seward, hauled coolers, knives, and other gear down a hill to the stinking, rotten whale carcass. When they arrived, multiple people, along with small children, were on the beach looking at the whale, which had been cordoned off with plastic orange fencing. NOAA had issued a warning the day before, saying people and pets should stay away from the whale. That's in part because of the risk of disease. They don't know yet how it died, and it could be infectious. There's also the risk that hundreds of pounds of rotting whale flesh will attract bears and cause possible interactions between bears and humans. Despite the warning, NOAA Fisheries Law Enforcement Officer Noah Meisenheimer says he isn't surprised to see so many people around the whale, which could be helping keep the bears away.
Bear activity is going to be limited. I mean, there might be some bears that may come out at night, but during the daytime with this many people, I doubt they'll be making a showing.
With all their gear strategically laid out in a semicircle around the whale carcass, veterinarian Kathy Burrick gave a safety briefing to the team conducting the necropsy. That included warnings to avoid slipping on blood or blubber and staying hydrated. Also, there's the smell.
Some people, depending on if they're not used to being around things that smell bad, we have had people pass out, okay? So it's nothing to be ashamed of, but just kind of be aware of that. If things are like closing in on you, just go ahead and sit down.
After Burrick shared a few more tips and tricks, the team set to work, first measuring the whale, then using long knives and hooks to cut and peel away the blubber. That allows them to get at internal organs like the stomach and bladder to conduct further sampling. Burrick says they hope to examine the whale's earwax, which builds up annually like the rings of a tree and can tell them the whale's age. For now, they are describing it as a yearling. Mahoney, the NOAA biologist, says there are no obvious signs of broken bones that might indicate the whale was struck by a ship. The biologists don't know yet when they'll have answers or if they can even determine the precise cause of the whale's death because of the decomposition. In Anchorage, I'm Casey Grove.
Alaska wildlife officials have launched new research into a highly endangered population of beluga whales. Aided by more than $1.3 million in federal grants, the research is aimed at determining why belugas in Cook Inlet have not recovered. The white whales were declared endangered in 2008. Mandy Keough, a physiologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, says the population has remained suppressed at only 340 animals. One study will analyze teeth from hunted or stranded belugas to determine how whale feeding habits have changed. Chemical signatures in teeth can reveal whether belugas ate fish in the water column or prey along the ocean floor. Using acoustic equipment, researchers will try to determine where belugas feed in winter and whether noise is affecting them. teachers can have lifelong influence on students. Their work is important, and each year, the Alaska Department of Education celebrates them by choosing a Teacher of the Year. The winner will be selected next month from a group of four finalists. This week, we're bringing their voices to the air. Skagway High School English and History teacher Kent Fielding started his career in Kentucky before moving to Alaska. Fielding taught at Mount Edgecumbe before Skagway, where he has taught for the past 12 years. He says technology, especially phones, can be a challenge in school, but he says in Skagway, it's crucial.
Because all my kids travel for basketball across country. They're involved in almost everything. They're gone, you know, sometimes a week at a time. But it makes it so much easier for me to communicate to them and teach them actually online, which is what sometimes I'm essentially doing. But I can imagine, you know, having taught in Central Hardin in Kentucky, where I had classes of 39, that it's probably almost impossible to, like, keep track of all the devices, particularly phones.
Understanding the relevance of events in education, historical context, is really important. How do you work to help students understand those connections so that they can really learn and engage with why it's important to know what happened before to inform what will happen in the future?
You know, one thing that, you know, we talk about in the classes, you know, this idea of a, particularly in our current political, you know, context, is the dangers of a single story. You know, a single story is like, if the only thing you know about Mexicans are that they're illegal immigrants, you have a stereotype that is untrue and you can't really see them as people. So when you start talking about this single story, I have kids pick out their single stories because they all have single stories about something, you begin to actually be able to maybe connect the past. I mean, it's easy to connect perhaps to some of the things that are going on today with, you know, the white supremacy, the events in Charlottesville. So the idea of, like, understanding the past can also help us understand the future. I mean, understand the present.
You said that for me, getting education to go beyond the classroom is the whole point of education. Well, what do you mean by that?
Well, I think we want to create lifelong learners. I think that's the whole purpose of education. And this past year, you know, we went to the Marshall Islands to study climate change. Because Marshall Islands are atolls that are meters above seawater. And they're places that are going to be, you know, first affected by climate change, along with northern, you know, Alaska. You know, I wanted the kids also to make the connections. And in October, they're actually hosting a climate change conference in Skagway. In the Marshall Islands, the things that we did was we visited high schools, but we talked to leaders. We met with the president, Dr. Hilda Hine, the female Marshall Islands president. We talked to community members. We looked at, the erosion of seawalls. So it was like a nonstop learning project. And, you know, now they're promoting this climate conference, which is like their own thing.
What do you think the future of education will look like? Will it be automated? Will there still be teachers? What do you think it will be, and what do you think it should be?
I think we're moving more and more to computer-based learning, more online. I don't think we'll ever, I mean, I hope we don't ever get rid of the classroom teacher, because I do think the teacher is important, primarily because I think one of the big reasons why students succeed is the relationship that students have with their teachers.
Kent Fielding is one of four finalists to be Alaska's next Teacher of the Year. Tomorrow, we'll hear from Tri-Valley School fourth grade teacher Karen Martin. More information is at our website, alaskapublic.org. A team of explorers and scientists returned to Nome earlier this month after attempting to be the first to sail to the North Pole. KNOM's Gabe Colombo has the story.
The three-week expedition called Arctic Mission was led by British explorer Penn Haddo, who had previously trekked solo to the North Pole from Canada across sea ice. Haddo says on this trip, the international crew of 10 and their trusty dog, Fukimi, hoped to make a global statement about climate change.
Reaching the North Pole, while interesting as a technical challenge, is actually going to have far more serious consequences as a sort of a global warning signal, if you like, that something very substantial is happening across a substantial surface area of the planet.
That something is the melting of ice in the Arctic Ocean. The team's two yachts, Bagheera and Snow Dragon 2, spend much of their time harbored in Sitka. Both vessels are sturdily built of steel and aluminum, which allows them to navigate through ice channels not much wider than their hulls. Francis Bran, skipper of Snow Dragon, says the ice can give a false sense of protection.
That ice is very serene, very still, like being in a harbor when it's not windy. If it's very windy, it would be a place that you wouldn't want to be, because those huge sheets of ice wouldn't just drift slowly around. They'd be moving faster. You'd have a potential to get crushed.
It's ultimately that wind which made the crew decide to turn back at around 80 degrees north latitude. According to the team, that was still as far north as almost anybody has made it by water. Tim Gordon, marine biologist and head scientist on the mission, also says,
"It was actually very relieving to see some ice. We'd spent 2 weeks sailing north in what is meant to be an area that is frozen solid all year round, sailing through open water. And to know that there is still some of it that is frozen all year round was actually quite heartening for me."
They also took heart at the amount they were able to accomplish. The crew gathered data on marine ecosystems that have been long out of reach under the ice. Gordon says this will help scientists begin to understand how things like plastic pollution, ocean acidification, and increased noise are affecting these organisms. There was personal growth too, says Heather Boucher, a wildlife biologist. One research task took her away from the sailboats.
Some fog rolled in, and there was a moment where I realized, oh man, it was such a sense of relief and accomplishment too, to be able to say that, you know, we went out in this tiny little dinghy and sat in the central Arctic Ocean surrounded by fog and were able to navigate our way back.
The team hopes that missions and research like theirs will prompt more legal protections for the Arctic, citing those already in place in Antarctica. Bran, skipper of Snow Dragon, is optimistic.
We can make change, and this is something I think those of us who've spent significant time in Alaska are aware of. There's less people, more access to our government, and they're more likely to be responsive. I hope those of us who've had political successes in the past can convince others who are newer to the game that it can be done, we can make a difference. Don't just give up.
For now, as samples are sent to England for analysis and the boats sail home to Sitka, the team says they're just happy to be back on dry land. Reporting in Nome, I'm Gabe Colombo.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Zachariah Hughes and Casey Grove in Anchorage, Avery Lill in Igiagic, and Gabe Colombo in Nome. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.